Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 268 of the Roguecast, recorded September 3rd, 2019. Something is killing the children.
It's September, guys, or September, as Dave likes to call it.
Yep, it's catching on, and everybody should be into it. If you think of September as the prequel to Halloween month, you can kind of start gearing up. You could start putting your costume together. You could start watching horror movies like I'm going to do. You want to get pre-spooky.
So let me ask you, don't prequels suck?
No.
No.
You can't let Star Wars define everything.
And name a good prequel.
I can't Under Pressure. There's probably one out there. I mean, probably not, but... well, think about it this way, then. It's really a prelude. It's a prelude.
Preludes are good. Yeah. Prequels suck.
Yes. What is it? I don't ever watch American Horror Story, but I saw the trailer for the new one, and it's all like slasher
80s. 84, right?
It looks like it's going to be kind of fun and pop. There's going to be a lot of 80s stuff going on this year, because it's also... what is it this year or next year that Wonder Woman 1984...
Next year.
Got it. Bummer.
Yeah.
But still, I'm happy to see the 80s represented. I guess thank you, Stranger Things.
Yeah. So I'm not the biggest horror guy in the world.
Yep.
Unlike my compatriots here. But I do see horror movies, like, basically during October, I go back and catch whatever I've been hearing about that's supposed to be good. So I solicited, this year I decided to try it for all of September and October.
You're a dabbler in things spooky.
I am a spooky dabbler.
Yep.
You already started it with Ready or Not.
I did.
Yeah, that's true. That counts. That's close enough.
So I'm embarking upon my horror. So I posted on my Facebook and I was like, "Hey, everybody, give me
one single suggestion." They immediately did not.
And I said, "No cheating. You get one."
Yeah.
It took about three comments for someone to post.
Yep.
And I post four, and I was like, "No cheating."
Yep. I'm seeing it this week with that person. That's just how it is. Horror fans cannot contain their glee, and they want to share with you their choices. I did see some good ones in there. A few stinkers too.
I'm gonna ask you for your guidance on some of that.
But mostly reasonable choices. I just think some of them, like, there are ones that I'm like, I don't think this will be a Randy thing.
Yeah.
Well,
it's like last year when I watched The Witch, and you're like, you're not gonna like that, and you were right.
Yeah. And I think, did you decide to skip out on Hereditary?
I did. Hereditary and Midsommar, I know that's not going to be for me. I know it's good.
Right.
It's not going to be for me.
And I think that you have correctly assessed yourself, sir.
Yes. I can do that. If I do it too often, I go blind.
If you break down on either, on one of them, I'd say catch Hereditary at some point.
Really?
But it's like a disturby...
You wouldn't think Midsommar... Well, you didn't like Midsommar.
No, I liked it okay. I just am sort of still in make-up mind mode. It's weird, by the way. The director's cut is at theaters.
It is.
I was thinking if I wanted one, Midsommar would be the one.
It is, I guess, less disturbing, but it's also, I think, less compelling.
Okay.
The more immediate suspense and horror nature of the other one. Like, in some ways, Midsommar becomes like a weird dark suspense thing, but is also more character-y. Hereditary has like a tighter story. Wouldn't you say that, Nick? It's a little less meandering as far as the story goes, and it has a mystery and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I guess they both do, but I just think Hereditary is a more obvious, this is a kind of, it's fun in its way.
And I'm going to say the opposite. I think Midsommar is the better.
Oh, my God. No, I'm just kidding. You're entitled to that. You're entitled to that. But it's not better. This is better for Randy.
I think neither are good for Randy.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, too.
I think Hereditary is better. I think Randy needs to watch Insidious.
Insidious and Sinister are both on my list.
I think those are both good ones.
Sinister
not as good?
Yeah.
It's okay.
It has some... It is sort of on the disturbing side,
I mean,
and it has some, like... I'm going to say disturbing...
Don't watch the sequel.
Family deaths and things. Yeah, well, I don't think he was jumping to that place.
No, there's probably no sequels, except for I already watched Conjuring 2.
But I do think it's kind of effective. It just has a little bit of that tinge of, like... Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff like that, in the sense of, like, you might feel a little bit like you're watching creepy snuff film.
Well, yeah. I have a few things thrown at me that, like, I watched last year. Like, Train to Busan was recommended. I love Train to Busan.
Yep.
It's one of my favorite zombie movies, actually, at this point. And something else was recommended.
Oh, you haven't caught that one yet?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. That should go to your... Bird Box, weirdly, is on my list.
Oh, you know, that's probably one... I know that's one that I have recommended and would have been my recommendation had I thought about it, but I decided to change things up. But I really liked Bird Box.
Yeah, so we shall see. Every year I find a few that I'm like, oh, that's a good movie. I'm glad I saw it.
This year I ended up recommending The Bay.
Yeah.
Which is a good... I tend to veer towards ones when I'm recommending for you, Rennie, that I think are a little more fun, that are kind of have like a compelling story, but are not necessarily like really grisly or grim or anything like that.
I need a story in my horror.
And the Bay is a fun one, the found footage one, where like I was telling you, unlike the first of all, like being directed by Barry Levinson is an unusual thing for a found footage movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, it's the found footage in it is not like one lone cameraman who crazily stays with the story to the end, which even weirds me out sometimes, and I like found footage movies. But rather, all the collected footage from a small town after this strange incident occurs. So it's got like people's cell phone footage, like it could be a dashboard cam from a police car.
Somebody spliced it all together.
Yeah, have you not seen it?
I haven't actually.
Oh, okay.
I like Barry Levinson though.
Yeah, so. I mean they don't like literally say like this is like what the cops watched or something, but that is sort of the idea behind it. If they wanted to paint the narrative with as much detail as they could, and so they you get as many possible sources as they can pull together.
The other thing I wish when people are making recommendations,
yeah,
is this is one that one of our friends did, was they're like, it's on Netflix. I'm like, tell me where things are.
Yeah, I was actually thinking when I recommended The Bay, I was like, I don't know where that is, but I was thinking, maybe I should just buy that on Blu-ray or something on that. But the thing is, I'm probably going to move to digital. If everybody moves to digital...
We can't loan things.
Then
anymore.
We can't loan things,
yeah,
can we?
That's the trick.
That's going to come up. They'll come up with some way around that, right? Other than just pirating, obviously. But like where it's like, you can like give somebody 48 hours during which they can watch it.
No, they'll just want everybody to buy their own.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Bastards.
Yeah.
There's always something.
There's always something.
Why is the man always keeping us down?
I don't know.
Just hand out your password. Therefore, they can log into yours, watch what they want,
buy whatever they like.
It's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
All right. September does bring us a couple bits of store business, so we'll have Batman Day on Saturday, September 21st. There'll be a sale on Batman stuff.
Yep.
Some free Batman comics. We'll have Batman here for a little while.
And people should read The Long Halloween, because that's Batman and Halloween all in one.
It's a good thought. And then we'll have our magic pre-release for Knights of Eldraine at the end of the month, September 28th and Sunday 29th. So if you want to sign up for that, you can get signed up for that. All right. News. Not as much this week. No D23. But there's an interesting smattering of news here.
Yep.
So, IT director Andy Muschietti is directing The Flash. He, or at least according to him, that's his next movie. He's doing The Flash. No one seems to know whether Ezra Miller is in it or not in it.
Right. Last time we discussed this in the podcast, we were talking about how Ezra Miller had this weird thing where he wanted to write his own script.
So he
wasn't like happy with the one that they had, right?
Right. Yeah.
So yes, he went to Grant Morrison, and they were like, "All right, Ezra Miller, you've got a week or something like that to get a script to us."
Apparently, Grant Morrison saved the day,
and
or it didn't work out, and they're going with some of the script.
Right. We don't know, right?
Sure.
But I think I think Grant Morrison was like, "Just 1 week to write the whole script. Let me get my mushrooms.
I only need an hour."
That's right.
So
I won't even write it. I'll go into the idea space and I'll pluck it.
I know you guys were pretty much on board with the DC stuff, last couple things.
Shazam, Aquaman, and Wonder Woman should be sort of the standard bearers.
So all of those are directed to some extent by horror directors. Patty Jenkins is not just a horror director, but she did do Monster.
Mm.
This dude is not a horror director. What is with the horror?
You know
directors?
What's funny? But they are moving away overall from horror into a sort of a lighter sort of...
James Wan couldn't help but introduce some of that horror with, like, the trench.
Well, and sure, but it was... stuff in Shazam, too. The stuff with the sins is creepy.
Yeah, the lights out guy. Yeah,
but, like, overall, I don't think of that as, like, if somebody was like, what's Shazam like? I'm not going to say, like, it's kind of a slightly disturbing superhero movie. It's a mostly kind of an all-ages fun movie with a few creepy moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that a good horror director knows how to handle all the genres and kind of.
I don't know. Is it
DC's
thing.
Way to kind of have their grim dark without having it?
Yes, I feel like it might be.
If this is the way it's going to manifest, then it's much better than when they had like true grimdark Zack Snyder's on board.
Yeah.
And then they were trying to, everybody was trying to be Nolan. So, I guess I'm down with it. The weird thing is, although I am looking forward to seeing It Part 2 this week, and I think I've heard it's like it's, I know it's a longer one. I've heard the word ambitious thrown at it.
Okay, all right, yeah.
And that sounds interesting. I was not in love with the first one. I liked it. I liked parts of it, but I thought it also had some of the things I don't like about sort of horror movies that do lots of jump scares, that achieve a lot of that jump by just literally loud, jangly noises and stuff like that.
I rewatched it last week, just in kind of preparation.
Yep.
I think it holds up. I do agree that some of the there are kind of cheap jump scares, but viewed as a whole, the movie is pretty good for what it is.
I think it is pretty good. But I'll give you an example in it. And there is a, you know, the spooky house they go to?
Yeah.
I always thought, like, they're like, oh, it's that creepy old house or whatever. When you see it, it's almost comically creepy. Like, it looks over-designed. Everything about it is spooky and weird. And you're like, it doesn't look like it would have ever fit in the neighborhood. It, like, looks like Guillermo del Toro came in. He's like, I will design you a scary terror house. And if my memory is right from the book, it was like a dilapidated house that had something unnerving about it that scared the kids, but it wasn't like, oh my God, every centimeter of it is covered with something scary. So like the movie is a little on the nose that way.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I don't think they outright say it's like evil, but cause they do say people like live there, really? Or like they, that people kind of...
I guess I actually kind of do want to revisit it. Maybe I can get it sneak in a viewing before Thursday. So
the transient,
it's like...
Why don't you pull up your phone right now while we're podcasting?
Sure, why not?
get some Bill Skarsgård laughter into it.
But, so this guy is going to end up doing The Flash. I don't quite know what to make of it. Just as I didn't quite know what to make of James Wan doing Aquaman. Like, I had hopes because I felt like he was a talented director, and had he done some Fast and Furious stuff, or am I only thinking of Justin Lin?
Oh, no, that's Justin Lin.
Okay.
Justin Wan was Insidious. James Wan. They both start with J. Jimmy Wan.
Jesus Christ. All right. Before this gets uncomfortable. So I'm neither here nor there on it. He at least knows how to put together a movie, and I imagine, I hope he doesn't want to bring any horror to this one. Flash is one character that I really don't want that.
I could definitely see somebody doing Flash's body horror.
Yeah, or like when I'm running, the world blurs and I see things.
They see the world beyond.
I can see through the veil.
I think it's a stretch to do horror, but I'm sure you can do some of his villains is more horrific.
It just starts to run at super speed and his just arms and legs just wrench off.
Anyway, I have as much interest in this as I do all the DC movies.
Yeah. So do we know anything about it? Like,
no.
That no release date. Nothing. Or vague release
what
date?
What we know is the director said, hey, I'm going to do that next.
Right. He probably is. I don't think he would just randomly say that.
Sure.
No.
He's already got his ticket is wrote because it has been a big success.
Yeah, he's got his...
In similarly weird news, Guillermo del Toro is teaming up with director Issa Lopez, who did a movie called Tigers Are Not Afraid.
Okay.
Which is a thing I didn't know about.
All right.
And they are doing a werewolf western.
Oh, I saw our friend Cliff post this, and I was just like, you know what? Werewolf western sounds fun. I think the world deserves this.
Yep. Is Guillermo del Toro directing?
No.
He's writing it.
He's writing it. I have a mixed bag reaction to him. What are his best known movies? He's got Pan's Labyrinth. He's got Devil's Backbone.
Pacific Rim.
Hellboy. Any other horror
that
ones?
Curse of the Crimson thing. Crimson Peak.
He didn't do Mama, did he?
No, he produced it.
I have always found that I like his proteges better than him.
Well, this sounds sort of in that same vein because he's not directing.
Yeah, the director is
like
a protege.
He produced Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yep.
He was a sort of the director of I Know Mama was a protege of his, and there's some other movie that is it The Orphanage? Maybe
The Orphanage or The Others, one of those. Yeah.
Not The Others,
no.
Okay. But it might have been The Orphanage. And I like I always like him. But the one thing he is a story guy. He kind of does dark fairy tales sometimes, and I don't always love his stuff. But I've liked it. I liked Crimson Peak, horror western with werewolves. Right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
All right,
I don't know if there's too many movies that are supernatural western.
It's certainly not happening a lot, and I think there's been one or two But I don't think anybody that have been good.
Yeah.
Is there any good ones?
I can't think of any.
I saw years ago that was, like, I think a kind of under-the-radar one called, like, Dead Birds. That was set during the Civil War. It wasn't without its moments, but overall it was forgettable. So, sure, bring it on. Can you make the horror western of our times? Guillermo del Toro and other person?
So, keeping with the theme of horror, Adult Swim is apparently doing an adaptation of Uzumaki, done by Junji Ito, which is one of our favorite horror things.
It's so creepy.
This is an animated adaptation, like an anime thing. I don't know why. I don't have any interest in adaptations of his stuff.
Is it because so much of his stuff is his own style?
I think so, and I think it's the way I feel about a fair number of, like, potent writer artists in comics. It's why I've never really wanted to see Dark Knight Returns adapted, that DC animated adaptation. Yeah. Like, the faithful or not doesn't really matter to me. It's like, can it handle the... Can it recreate the potency of a writer-artist combo at their peak? And I almost always find the answer is no for me. So... that said, I think I've heard they've adapted some of his other stuff to animation, I think, successfully. I kind of heard the live-action one was a little middling, maybe kind of some cheesy CG effects.
I don't know how you do his, like, visuals in the actual, like, real world, kind of.
Yeah.
Without it looking cheesy.
I think that was probably what the problem with the live-action one. Although a few people have told me otherwise.
Let's do a live-action Gyo.
I'd be willing to check out an animation thing, but, like, I think it's that dingy black and white art. I love it.
Yeah.
I don't want it in color in a weird way.
I kind of agree with you. Like, I'm excited to see more people know Junji Ito's work.
Right. He is for sure the star is on the rise. I remember, like, 10 years ago, and I felt like we would mention his name and nobody ever knew it.
Yeah.
And now I know, like, a lot of horror fans who know it. And he's been memed, and, you know, I think in those circles, he's heralded as the god of horror comics.
Right. Marvel is developing an America Chavez series for Disney Plus. We don't know much about this yet, but this is lesbian character from a utopia who has, like, flight and super strength and can teleport, can open dimensional gateways.
Yeah.
And she comes to our Earth and sees that it's not great and she's going to fix it. And she's been one of these characters that a lot of people really like.
Yeah.
But has been a bit on the fringe of popularity. So there's sort of a question of whether I feel like something like, did you say this is live action?
Yeah.
A live-action show could bring her to the fore in a way that I think could be really good for the character. Yeah.
And it would be a lesbian Latinx character, which is not something that Marvel's done a ton of. So that's pretty cool.
I wish it the best. So the character, I have to admit, is one that's been below my radar too. I think I tried a few of the books that she was in and didn't quite plug into them.
Yeah.
But that could be that. A, maybe it's possible that they weren't great books, and also, not everything has to be for me.
Yeah.
So I wish them well, and I think it would be cool to, I know a lot of hard work has gone into those books, so if the show takes off, hopefully that would also shine a spotlight on the work that's come out so far.
Finally, Watchmen, David Lindelof's Watchmen, has gotten a premiere date, October 20th. So we're a month and a half out? Almost 2 months out.
Yeah. I'm excited.
But that's cool. That means this year. I wasn't sure it was going to happen this year.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty excited about that. I really like the last trailer, so I'm looking forward to it. So,
what was the date?
October 20th.
October 20th this year?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's coming
up. That's nice and fast.
You're going to have to restart your HBO subscription.
I am. Well, it's also... Silicon Valley is also premiering that night, and I don't want to watch the last season of that. And I think the new Catherine Hahn, Mrs. Fletcher, is coming on that week, so... That'll be enough to get me back to HBO, and I can finally watch that Deadwood movie.
And remind me, is this being released all at once, or they're doing it weekly?
It's weekly.
Okay, yeah. That's kind of cool.
I think the weekly thing is coming, going to be coming a more standard thing.
Disney Plus adopting it makes a big difference.
Well, I saw Netflix deciding to test the waters with it as well.
Interesting, because that Netflix is the last people I would expect.
Is it any particular show?
No, I just saw an article floating around. I didn't click on it. I saw the headline that Netflix is toying with their, like, limited ones to try out to see how it works.
I do know that my friends who like to binge them, stay up late, watch the whole season in one fell swoop, are not going to be wild about this.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I don't think they'll do it for Stranger Things or some of, like, their big iconic ones. Right.
I would think that is where they would do it, actually.
Yeah.
Where the interest is there already.
Yeah, I mean, despite Game of Thrones' lackluster final season, I've rarely seen a show that was more buzzworthy, and they accomplished a lot by having it as a... that was not released.
It was weekly.
So yeah, so you get to talk and dissect the events, like we mentioned before when we were talking about this. I think it'd be interesting if they did it. Personally, obviously, I'm in favor of it. Sorry to anybody who's not who likes to binge it, but you're wrong. you chose the wrong way to watch TV.
You don't watch enough TV. A binge for you is watching two episodes.
That's true. That's true. But I want things to accommodate me and not hordes of others.
That seems fair.
So I think it's pretty reasonable. Actually, no, it's kind of partially for the good of the show, and because I do think maybe a little something is legitimately lost when you just funnel cram all the episodes of a show and you don't give it a little bit of room to breathe in your headspace.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could argue it's like reading a book all in one sitting or something like that, or reading a bunch of chapters. I don't know. We probably won't resolve it here on this podcast.
No, let's fix it right now. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to resolve this, and then...
When we get back, we'll have the answer.
Yep. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 4th, and week one.
Week one, right.
A lot of number ones this week, and I think we all picked a number one.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Although, ironically, I think only Nick has one that's actually a series.
So, Randy, is that your pick?
Yeah, Dave and I both pick one shot.
So I got Marvel, Randy got DC, and Nick, you got...
Boom.
Okay, interesting, yeah. Interesting.
Anyway,
it's
Nick,
a pantheon. If only Randy wasn't always hyping up DC so much.
I know. I love DC Comics so much.
Why don't you just pipe down about it just for once?
All right. Nick?
Well, let's continue with the horror-themed books.
Yeah.
Themed talk, because this one is Something is Killing the Children.
What is it?
That is a good question. It is answered in
this. I just
want
to repeat. That is the actual title of it, y'all. The title is Something is Killing the Children.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit in your face.
It is in your face. It's brutal and violent.
It is literally about what it says, but it's only brutal kind of towards the end. A lot of it is this very creepy vibe, right? Don't you think?
Like, the opening is about... basically a group of little kids, little kids.
What,
like,
12 or 13?
Yeah,
or 14
somewhere
or 15 maybe?
Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark. Maybe freshmen in high school, I would say. And they're having like a sleepover, and they're talking, trying to tell scary stories. They're playing Truth or Dare. Yeah. And the guy asks, tell me the thing that scared you the most. So he comes up with the story, and...
But it sounds a little bit real the way he says it, where he says that he like... was home alone and he heard something outside, like near a ravine that they live near, and there was this really like tall, like I forget how tall.
It's like this like,
9 foot
giant,
tall or something.
Giant thing that's
had
like in his yard.
Yeah, super long hands and was like the way the specifics he mentions in it. Like he's like it looked confused, like the light on the house had confused it or something, and it was like it's a kind of a weird detail you wouldn't. Just think to make up if you were just telling a story, but they do think he's just telling a story.
And then the next scene is that same kid telling the story in a interview room in a,
like
police,
a police
station. His shirt covered in blood, and him basically mumbling to himself that it wasn't real, that he made it up.
Right,
and,
as if something very bad has happened, and so like how could that have happened when I just made it up?
Right. It's just an interesting book, and the art is very
effective.
I
thought the art was really good.
It reminds me a lot of Tim Sale.
Yeah, there's something of Tim Sale. There's also a little bit of something I actually thought of Dan Mora.
Yeah, I agree with
a little
that.
Bit in there. But for sure, the faces and stuff reminded me of Tim Sale, and it has that cool, like, you know how his color work looked on, the Marvel color series, Spider-Man Blue, Daredevil Yellow, and all that. It has a little bit of that sort of slightly washed out but really beautiful colors look to it. Tonally, this is I thought one of the creepier stories I've read in a while. It's more like the horror that I would want than like just straight
monsters. Yeah, I could actually easily see this as a TV show or something like that on like FX, because it handles horror and kind of like the just insanity and grotesquerie, but also handles small stuff like the situations where this kid
is
mostly like
characters talking to each other.
This kid dealing with like bullies and
he has an interesting conversation with the principal
with a
young principal who's like kind of surprisingly candid with him.
And then there's this girl that is somehow tied into the kind of
the creature or whatever
creature
it
or
is,
the monsters or whatever. And she is, I guess, there to help him.
She's sort of investigating it, on the prowl for it, and she's the sort of strange X factor, which I'm sure we'll find out more about next issue.
But it feels very much kind of like hack slash meets Buffy meets.
I think
R-rated.
It's not. Neither of the like both Buffy and hack slash are kind of genre action adventure-y, and this felt more like The Ring. In the sense of characters investigating something that they are not equipped for the most part.
Right.
And it specifically, what made me think of The Ring was the opening. You know how The Ring opens with the two girls kind of had a sleepover talking about the mythology of it? That sort of, the opening of this reminded me of that in a good way, because I think that's a great opening.
I do too. But yeah, it's a great first issue. If you are in the horror mood, I would definitely recommend.
Just a reminder, it's called Something is Killing the Children.
Dave is really going to make you not forget that one.
It's an unusual title. And you might be like, what's the one with the dead kids? And you're like, Something is Killing the Children.
I'm going to do that to all the people who come in tomorrow.
Do you have that book? Do you mean Something is Killing the Children?
No, I meant that X-Men book.
Yeah, that's right.
Dave?
I've got a sort of nostalgia piece here. I've always had a fondness for Alpha Flight
Canada. You're always eating poutine.
Look, the cover to this has the whole team, if I'm not mistaken, eating poutine.
You're always playing hockey, drinking maple syrup straight from a bottle.
I must be anti-Canadian. Is that possible?
I will say that all the creators who worked on this, they're Canadian.
Are Canadian, yeah, I saw that. So this is a three-issue story, or it's a three-part anthology. Where each one, I actually, I don't normally like books like that, but I felt each one in this had something interesting to say. They're usually kind of emotional stories from the team's past, and they're not interconnected other than the sense that there's an emotional component to all of them. And I do have a connection to Alpha Flight in the sense that I was literally there in like 1981 or 82, whenever that debuted. I think it's 81.
Yep.
And when John Byrne was writing and drawing it. And I still really love those first really weird 22, 23 issues, whatever it was he did. Maybe a little more than that. Alpha Flight, you could tell, was a series that even Byrne, when he was doing it, they had debuted in X-Men, but it was like he didn't quite know what he wanted to do with the series. Sometimes it was kind of weirdly serious and dark. The team almost never got together as a team fully. There was a lot of, they broke up into smaller groups a whole lot. They were kind of a weird anti-team team the same way the Defenders were, but they were the Defenders of the North.
Yes.
The Great White North. And so let's take us to where we are in this. Alpha Flight True North. I'm just going to quick run through with the gist of each of the stories or kind of an overview.
Yeah, that's something interesting. Three stories?
Three stories. There's Jim Zub writing, Ed Brisson, and Jed McKay.
All Canadians.
Yep. And Jed McKay is the only one who I kind of don't know what
his
thing is. He
did that Daredevil miniseries I really liked. And
was it the one that was right before the new launch?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And he's written a few things. I tend to like his stuff.
He wrote one of the stronger stories in here,
I liked
all three of them. The third one was a little weird and dark because it touched on a history I didn't know, and I was like, that's messed up if so, but let's start from the beginning. There's one that has Snowbird, the sort of shape-shifting, magical and yet also feral character in the book. She's kind of otherworldly, and, what's her name?
Talisman,
the daughter of Shaman.
Yep.
And this is really beautifully drawn, I should say that, first of all. I don't know who Max, or I forget who Max Dunbar is. I know the name, but I can't remember his thing. But I think it's really nicely drawn. They're on the hunt for a sort of a supernatural killer, and they run up against some nasty stuff that ends up having a sort of a mystical component with some monsters and stuff. It gives them both opportunities to use their powers. I really like that Jim Zub in his narration straight up said what their powers were. It's kind of a little bit of a lost art, and I know that, like, ideally you reveal it through the story, but if you're going to do a little narration, I think it's okay to kind of let people know what these characters' powers are, especially also, when it's weird like Snowbirds.
I feel like they tweaked Talison's powers a little bit, because she just had sort of generic magical power. She could, like, drain it. But she, like, can use magical effects from Canada, so it's like, she says that she casts a light spell that's, like,
she's
the
actually
light of the
from
eastern...
The, yeah, she, like, the sunlight that's hitting, like, the east coast or whatever, is she magically transports it to, like, attack one of these, like, dark feral creatures, and that was really cool.
Yeah.
The story ends up having a connection to one of their pasts in sort of a big way, and I thought it was well handled. Again, sometimes these are touching on story elements that came from after Burns' time that a lot of it is much more sketchy in my mind, but I know bits and pieces.
Yep.
The next one, maybe I like the best from Jed MacKay.
Yeah, this is my favorite
thing. Has the team, they're like vacationing on Prince Edward Island, and there's a lot of Canadian stuff in here. It's kind of nice. North Star and Aurora are just getting their tans and being the kind of, I don't know...
Arrogant jerks,
but I was also going to say slightly hedonistic. That's their sort of thing.
I've forgotten that Aurora was like that. For some reason in my head, I had her... She was like the opposite of...
Well, you know, she had multiple personality disorder. She had her school... her prim and proper school teacher thing, and then, like, the glasses fall down and the hair comes undone, and then she's a...
Wild.
She's a party seductress.
Yeah.
But they're just out sunbathing, and so Puck finds himself hanging out with... God, what's her name?
Marina. Marinara.
Yep. And he tells a... She's like, hey, tell me a story. And he ends up telling this story from his past, which is cool because it's from his pulp adventure days in the 1930s.
Yep.
And they put him together alongside some other pulp characters that I don't know. I don't think they had ever been spoken of in the same thing. One is Ulysses Bloodstone, the monster hunter, and the other is Fat Cobra, which readers of Immortal Iron Fist will recognize as one of the Iron Fist. What do they call them? Living Weapons.
Yeah.
For part of that lineage.
Yep.
But it's a story that also has a personal link to Marina that he ends up coming out. And I don't know who drew this one, but I really like it. Jibril Morissette-Fan. I'm sure I butchered that, but that is the name as it looked. And it reminds me of, who was that guy who drew Fallen Angel way back when?
Jesus.
Yeah, it reminded me of him. I don't know, that's an obscure artist to mention.
David Lopez.
Yeah. Who I think drew something else this week, like Buffy. I think he might have drawn that, but it was another good story. Last one concerns Heather Hudson, aka Vindicator, the second Vindicator or Guardian. I don't remember what they. Sometimes they go by different ones.
Yeah.
And her daughter and a threat to her to the daughter and some. There's like some action adventure in it. Not everything is what it seems. There's some questionable connection, like her husband. Who has been dead at times before. They've all been dead. It's Alpha Flight has a sort of complicated history. But one of the things I liked about this is that they touched on all those things without making me feel like I needed to know it all.
Well, that's one of the things. The hacky writers will come in and they're like, we're going to show we're serious by killing off one of the major characters. Mm-hmm. And as a result, literally every member of Alpha Flight has been dead at some point because hacky writers killed off characters for drama.
Yep. Yeah, it's an unfortunate thing, and now in the ways they have to deal with the fallout of it, but...
I remember when Bendis killed off the entirety of Alpha Flight in one panel.
I said, hacky writer. Killed off Alpha Flight.
Yeah, he also killed off Carnage at one point, so I guess credit where due. No.
Yeah. But you can't keep Carnage dead.
You can't.
I'm just saying, where's Sasquatch? Where's Shaman?
He didn't get to be in this one.
Sasquatch
is
busy in Immortal Hulk.
That's kind of what I figured.
He does get more screen time than the rest.
Yeah.
And some of them have been showing up, of course, in Captain Marvel more recently as part of, like, the space-based team.
Is Shaman dead? Shaman's not dead, is he?
He might be.
He's at the very least not in the story, but since these are kind of... Some of these are flashback-y, it doesn't particularly matter to it. But they're all well-drawn and interesting. I feel like anybody who's an Alpha Flight person should go ahead and check it out. And even if you don't know them, but you might want to like a little taste of Alpha Flight, you're going to get to see a fair number of the team. You're going to get to see them use their powers and get a sense of their personalities. It's not a bad little sampling.
I would like Jed MacKay to write an Alpha Flight series.
That'd be dope. Any of the artists inside, I think I actually liked all of the artists in there, would be down with it. I don't know who did the cover, but I like the cover. It's felt more Alpha Flight-y to me than any of the last, I'm going to say the last two or three abortive attempts to bring them back. I haven't really liked any of those. So the fact that I ended up liking an Alpha Flight thing is quite a celebratory moment.
Yeah.
Randy, what have you?
So my pick is a one-shot, but it's a series I've picked several issues of, and this is Deceased, A Good Day to Die. This is a sort of a aside. It's got a couple different artists, Derek Robertson and Laura Braga. It is all written by Tom Taylor, and it is a focus on... He did this kind of thing in Injustice 2, where he would, like, step away from the main story and look at what a couple characters were affected by it. So Mr. Terrific is trying to reverse engineer the zombie virus and cure it. Meanwhile, Barda and Mr. Miracle have gone into Apocalypse to discover that the whole thing is wrecked. They wind up working together alongside Booster Gold and Blue Beetle. And
Apocalypse was the source of the thing, right?
Yep. And they turn up John Constantine in what is a pretty hilarious bit. As they try to figure out, well, can we stop this zombie invasion with magic or with time travel?
Okay.
And it's a really good story. It's
Is this going to be the only one shot for Deceased?
I believe so. Yes.
Or okay, that's interesting.
It is a good sort of zombie survival one shot story that also introduces some characters who aren't going to be in the main Deceased story. I quite enjoyed it. As always, Taylor has really good moment to moment stuff, especially between, of all people, Constantine and Wave Rider.
That is an odd pairing.
Yep.
The Wave Rider thing threw me for.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Has Wave Rider been in any of the rest of the story?
No, but I
Wave Rider was kind of like a time travel force, right? Kind of trying to keep things from getting too janky.
Anyway, this series is really good. This one shot. Don't read it if you're not reading the series, because it would make no sense to you at all.
I don't know. Somebody might want to read some John Constantine weirdness.
It's possible.
But yeah, it sounds like it's a should fit right in with anybody who's reading Deceased, which is a lot of people.
Yeah. And I understand why it isn't in the main Deceased. It's a side story, so...
It would have felt odd.
Also on my stack this week, Star Trek Discovery Aftermath number 1, which picks up in the main timeline as Pike and Spock are dealing with what happened at the end of Discovery Season 2.
Yeah. There's actually more subplots going on in it than I expected. So there's stuff on the Klingon homeworld. And then there's, Pike and, what do you call it? Spock. As well as stuff with number 1. Like, there's actually, like, if you're reading it, there's a fair amount of stuff going in there.
What's interesting is, without giving too much away about how Discovery ends Season 2, these are threads we're not likely to see picked up in the TV show.
Right.
So it's kind of cool that they basically found a place to do a little exploration. I thought it was done pretty well. Die number 7, which is the second part of the second story arc. Really enjoyed it. Immortal Hulk number 23, I've been really digging that. And this is the Hulk squad going after General Fortune and his, like, evil military thing. Conan the Barbarian number 9. Conan winds up facing off with a lot of his old enemies through a sort of mysterious hallucination thing going on. Savage Avengers number 5, which I've been enjoying. Ghost Spider number 1, which is just an annual that has Gwen against Arcade.
Yep.
And it was a lot of fun.
Oh, nice. We were just talking about Arcade recently in the store and our love for him.
And Usagi Yojimbo number 4, which is a fun, looks like a two-part story about a woman who's an artist and her abusive samurai husband. And then finally, there's a graphic novel this week called Wait, What? Which is a... it's from Oni Press's Limerence Press, which is their same place that does Ojo Sex Toy and all that kind of stuff. And it is a comic book guide to relationships, bodies, and growing up, aimed at sort of teens. It is partnered with Scarletine, which is a sex ed website for teenagers. Some of the people writing it are involved with that. And it basically just runs through sort of... there's a segment here that is called Weird Genitals. And a page that says, just so you know, a whole bunch of genitals are on the next couple of pages.
So this would be a thoughtful, but looks like a little bit some humor in there to keep it from getting too serious or whatever, way to help kids figure out the scary stuff that's happening to them when they're kids or when they're growing up.
It's a great puberty age sex ed thing.
That's good.
It also is really well written, has some nice art, and is very trans and queer inclusive. It's a fantastic book that I would highly recommend to people, and it's like $12.
Oni's adult line is putting out some good stuff.
It goes right along with stuff they've done for Limerence, which includes a quick and easy guide to they/them pronouns and a quick and easy guide to queer and trans identities. They're doing educational comics in sort of a sexual space. It's a thing nobody else is doing, and somebody should be, and I'm glad it's there. And it's also just, it looks great.
Yep. I think, it's actually like they're doing great work because it's like, this is areas that people need to know about and not be just like have to go through their teens terrified of. You
also,
know?
They're fun. It's, yeah. It's really well done. The cartooning is good. So.
Yeah, it looks it. Just same way like Ojoy's sex toy and the basics and stuff like that have a lot of humor in them.
Dave, what else is on your stack?
Let's see. Did you mention the second issue of Berserker Unbound? That's the Jeff Lemire's Barbarian and Transported to the Modern Times book series. The first issue was a little bit lackluster for me, but I liked this one better because he meets up with a homeless guy, and the series then becomes, instead of following all the barbarian tropes, becomes a sort of a dialogue between them. And this issue was kind of fun because they both are talking to each other, neither can understand each other, and they both have different goals. but also there was like... He's like looking at like this like small like this homeless community under under a bridge, and he's like you know what ruler is it who lets this squalor in his land? And I was like, oh, we're gonna get some little barbarian wokeness maybe here. Actually, nothing is like it doesn't particularly call attention to that. That doesn't seem to be the reason it's there, because it's also the homeless guy is just like he's just trying to go through his day and get some food and maybe get some booze. And but they're clearly going to end up forming a bond, and I'm liking it more as it goes along. So it's now, as of this issue, kind of got me on board. Let's see. You mentioned we got Harley Quinn, Poison Ivy. They're kind of road tripping 6-issue miniseries by is it Jody Houser?
Jody Houser, yeah.
Yeah.
Some notable things happened to both of them during Heroes in Crisis, and this is sort of the follow up to that.
Yep, and tying in a little bit to the what's the villains thing?
Villains United.
Villains United. Yep. There's the 5th issue of Batman Ninja Turtles, Batman Ninja Turtles 3, which is the one that has all the blurred universe stuff, and we're closing in on the big climactic battle things. There's weird team-ups here working alongside, you know, Splinter and Shredder working together, all sorts of unusual combos of team-ups, and it was a lot of fun. Let's see, new storyline starting up in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, call it for the Hellmouth series.
Which I think is going to be a separate miniseries teaming Buffy and Angel for the first time.
Oh, interesting, okay. But this is actually still in the regular issue, yeah. So like they're going to kind of spin it off of that. That makes sense. 4th issue of Transformers Ghostbusters, and just because I want to say it again, I also really liked Something is Killing the Children.
Something is Killing the Children. Nick, Something is Killing the Children.
Yes, it is. Something is indeed killing the children. Lois Lane number 3. And Greg Rucka and Mike Perkins continue to kind of kill it on that book.
You know, I want to dive in real quick and just mention that I like that issue too. And it's an issue that's mostly about Lois and Superman kind of talking. There's definitely...
Well, it's their relationship and how Lois doesn't need to be... Protected by him.
Yeah, I like that it was kind of subtly done, like where she like they had like some sort of public, like not a press conference, but there was a thing where they were in the public, and he sort of made a point to kind of like stay with the cameras for a little bit. And at first, I was like, oh, is Rucka saying that he's a publicity hound? But no, the idea is that he was like he wanted to make it clear to anybody watching that he's got Lois's back.
Yeah.
And she's like, you don't have to do that kind of stuff for me. And in fact, it's kind of creating some awkwardness.
Yeah.
There was a lot of nice subtle details in there, as well as an ongoing mystery that deals with the question and the possible return of Vic Sage.
Yep.
The question. And some other interesting stuff going on. It looks like next issue is going to have her son, a.k.a. Superboy, show up.
Yep.
So what else?
Then... Brian Michael Bendis is launching the Legion of Superheroes with Millennium Number 1, which kind of goes through the ages of the DC history.
Their future history.
Viewed through a character that I don't know a ton of people if they know her. And I won't say, just because, spoilers. But it's an interesting look.
Futures like Commandy.
Yeah,
The Batman Apocalyptic, Beyond. Batman Beyond. Yeah.
And then, of course, the Legion.
Right.
But it's beautifully rendered by, like, Jim Lee, Dustin Nguyen.
Folks who have been looking forward, folks have been looking forward to the Legion stuff. Probably want to get some of this Prelude material and check it out.
Agreed. Then I've got Doomsday Clock number 11, which is the penultimate issue. Lots of stuff is happening in here. Sort of coming to learn what Ozymandias has really been doing. Black Adam and his cronies are kind of causing chaos. and how Superman is sort of at the center of everything, which is...
Are they going to say who Doomsday Clock is?
Yes.
Before it's over? Like, I hope they win the fight
against
Doomsday Clock, and he doesn't use his chrono powers to hit them badly.
No, Dave, Doomsday Clock is just the clock that Doomsday uses to wake up in time to kill Superman.
Wake up!
And then finally, House of X number 4, which is direct follow-up from the kind of big thing that shocking ending of the last one. More dark stuff is occurring.
Is that shocking ending? I'm not actually doing the what was the ending, but is it something that's known now? Is this the stuff with Moira, or is this something
else?
No,
it was something else.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we say what it was?
No.
Okay. I wasn't sure if enough time had passed.
But this ends with an even more shocking thing. So Hickman is kind of getting his big endings.
Who is he, Shyamalan?
Yes, this is him being Shyamalan.
They did say from the beginning that each issue would kind of recontextualize the previous one, so that actually is kind of built, is a little somewhat built into the premise.
So we will see what happens next, but I'm still really enjoying it.
That's it for Comics of the Week. We're going to be back in just a second to talk about some movies Gelflings. And TV and Gelflings. Okay, so let's talk Ready or Not.
Ready or Not, the suspense horror movie in which a newlywed bride is hunted.
Forced to play a game.
Forced to play a game, which ultimately involves her being hunted in a mansion.
Yep.
Did y'all, Randy, you hadn't seen the trailer for this.
I knew nothing about this other than people were saying it was a horror comedy, and some of my friends were talking about how good it was.
Yep.
And then Dave was like, it's not that good, don't go see it.
Yep. That sounds like me. I liked it all right, but I didn't love it, and I don't know if I quite revisit it particularly, but I do, like, I really like the premise, and I like parts of it.
I was very entertained by it.
Nick, you were big into it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I will say that, of people I know who have seen it, I feel like I am the only one who has, like, thought it was kind of eh. So, that said, I will now tell you the premise of it.
Yes.
So what you've got is an attractive young couple in their 20s.
Yeah.
She is marrying into money, but kind of not for the money. She just wants to live sort of a normal life. He's got a weird, eccentric, super rich family, and the wedding is being staged at their mansion, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's
a family whose money has been earned off of board games.
Right. It'd be like if it was somebody who had the Hasbro Empire or something like that. And he does it on like the right before they're about to do their vows, or like they're about to be called down for all the ceremony and stuff. He kind of gives her an out, which is a little bit weird. He's like, hey, just so you know, if you are having second thoughts, because I guess like his brother was kind of comes in and ribs him about it, and he's like, hey, you could get out. And he's like, you know, you really could. And you're like, huh, why is he going so out of his way to give this person he seems to be in love with a chance to get out?
Yep.
And part of it is because, as you glimpse in a flashback at the beginning, the family does have a weird, eccentric tradition. And it's not necessarily always violent. But, like, on the wedding night, the bride and groom, I guess, are both supposed to come down and join the rest of the extended family for a board game or one of the games in the family's line.
Yep.
Now, there's some mysteries to be had here, and I don't want to say all the whys and wherefores, like, why would they have this strange tradition? But one of them is it hide-and-seek? Is it actually, is that how they do it?
Yep.
And with a very particular murderous intent.
I was going to say, it's the only murderous game that they
could she play. She could have gotten their equivalent of, like, Candyland or something.
And she would never have known.
She would never have known.
Somebody got Old Maid.
Right.
What the hell is Old Maid?
Yeah, as one of the characters' notes. It is they are a fun cast of weirdos, the family.
Yeah, it's like there's two brothers and one sister, and they're all married, so it's all people who were brought into the family in various ways.
Yep.
It's a great cast.
One of them is like generally in a perpetual state of being coked up.
Yep.
And leads to some of the best. This is a dark comedy.
Yes.
And there's some accidental deaths and things like that.
Yep.
Without saying too much about the premise, pretty quickly she catches on that this is not going to be a normal night.
Yeah, well, and her sort of survival horror of, like, she's trapped in this one place, she's trying to get out, she's like the plucky heroine who is just a normal person who just got trapped into all this. Like,
yep.
They definitely do the sort of same thing, like, The Quiet Place did that one bit where you can see the nail in the stairs.
Oh yeah.
And you're like, you can see it coming, and you know what's going to happen, and that doesn't make it any easier.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they know how to do that kind of stuff where it's like, you can see and sympathize with her pain that she's in.
Yep.
And sympathize with the sort of the terror that she's got. And yet it's not, like, terrifying. It's just more of a, like, ooh, wow, that's yikes.
Yeah. It's got some moments that are meant to make you either, cringe a little bit, yeah. or to like tense up. It's not like full on horror or even like full on suspense, because the comedy breaks it up a fair amount.
Yeah.
But there's definitely moments where it's very suspenseful. Like at one point she's like hiding in the kitchen while yeah. like the butler guy is, what is he making, a sandwich or tea?
And he's making tea
and singing. Is it, what's the song? What's the classical piece that he's like singing?
Oh, I can't remember.
It's not 1812, or maybe it is 1812 Overture.
It might have been, and it kind of like frames it, and you're kind of like, sometimes you're only seeing her sneaking about from her perspective, and you have no idea what he's doing, and it's very, it's like very creepy and suspenseful.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also like, they're hunting her with like, what, only the old weapons of the family? Like,
yep. So one of the ancestral weapons.
One of the guys gets a crossbow, he doesn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Swords
and knives and things like that, but no like, no AK-47s.
Right.
The grandmother gets a giant axe.
The aunt.
Yeah,
and she's great.
She's a great character. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I actually really enjoyed this, especially not knowing anything going in. Which was, sorry, we've ruined that for you. But now know.
That was in the trailers.
You know, the big things.
Yeah,
I will say, just the cast is great, with like Andie MacDowell as the mom.
I don't know most of these people.
Adam Brody, who done a few television stuff, but he comes in and does a great performance as the kind of lost brother in a lot of ways. He's kind of just like mentally kind of checked out. Henry Cerny or Czerny as the dad is he's always great.
Yeah.
He's kind of, I guess I want to say he's the master of ceremonies of the strange night.
And Samara Wiley is actually really good, but I thought she was Margot Robbie for a long time.
She is Samara
Weaving.
She is very Margot Robbie-esque. I also was not 100% sure while I was watching it.
But she's great.
Yeah, she was in Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, and she was great in
that. She's got some good credits. I didn't recognize her. I thought she was Margot Robbie, and she's not. Dave, talk to us about puppets and Gelflings.
All right, now's the time for the weird, nightmare-inducing Jim Henson Muppet stuff.
How does it compare to the old Jim Henson Nightmare Fuel Muppet stuff?
You're talking about the Muppet Show? So the original Dark Crystal is, I think when we mentioned this show in the past, I've already said this before, but is like a really visually amazing thing with production designed by the famous 70s era fantasy artist Brian Froud, who did like, I feel like he must have been like the guy who designed all Ren Fairs and like Faye designs. Charles Vess, I feel like, is an artist who would have to be influenced by him.
Yeah.
And so you had this really, the weird thing about the original Dark Crystal, what made it so unusual is that Jim Henson, who had, through his works created Sesame Street and the Muppets, went to some very dark places in a dark fantasy story. I mean, it has dark right there in the title.
Yep.
But I also was never a huge fan. I always kind of wanted to like it. I couldn't fully plug in because it was kind of long and dreary and boring, despite a lot of great visual elements. It kind of has that, like, new-agey 70s crystal stuff where you're like, there's a lot of prophecies and solar alignments and things, and it doesn't, without sort of greater context, they don't mean a whole lot to me. Now, I know some people are really plugged into it, but I was always a person who just wanted to like it more than I did. Along comes Netflix's show, Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance. And I don't know a lot of behind-the-scenes production, but I do know it is meant to tie into the... It incorporates expanded universe stuff that they've had through, I think, a few key young adult novels that have been coming out since, like, the early 2010s. Mm-hmm. And a few of, I think, the graphic novels from Archaea Press are also, I think, kind of considered canonical within this. But it's a big... It expands a lot on it. It's a prequel.
Is it a prequel?
It is. Okay. Because, so here's what's sort of unique about this. The Skeksis, which are kind of more overtly vile in the original movie, they are like the Gelflings. They're little sort of elfy type humanoids. They're willing sort of servants in this. They are like, it's like the Skeksis are the one percenters. And there's definitely a vibe in this of like, of the sort of the awakening of sort of the Gelflings to the manipulations that they've been going on, that essentially You know, the Skeksis are not real subtle like this. They sound evil, but it's sort of like they also provide like technology. They understand the dark crystal that is tied to the world that sort of fuels everything. It's like they control that technology, and so they sort of lord their superior technology in a way, and their ability to understand it over the Gelflings. One of the things I immediately liked is that they, in a narration from Sigourney Weaver at the beginning, they tell you that there's like five different tribes of Gelflings, and there's one that's kind of like the underground tribe that's kind of sequestered off from the rest. There's one that's sort of the more military-oriented tribe. They're kind of great warriors. There's the scholarly ones that sort of rule over everything and have the closest ties to the creepy Skeksis vulture men. And it looks really beautiful. They combine some CG for, you can tell, for the backgrounds and certain creatures, but with a lot of classic puppetry. It looks like the classic movie, but I think better, you know? There's a few times when I was like, Nick, did you ever see it? The original one?
Yeah, I saw the original one.
You know those weird Landstrider things with real long legs that they ride like horses?
Yeah.
That are clearly, I think they're based on like a person in an actual like suit, like a sort of what would be a stilt walker at a carnival, but with creepy kind of somewhere between a rabbit and a deer, like costuming over them, does them. So they have those things in here. They still look super cool and weird, but sometimes when they're running around in the distance, they're for sure CG. It's good CG, but I kind of wish it was all just like almost like 100% practical except for some occasional spells and magical things.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, what happens here, what kind of sets the events going in, it is, I saw it somewhere said that this is like Game of Thrones with puppets, because there are actually, it frequently jumps around to different locations. It always flashes what the location is when you're there. So it's like, oh, this is in like the Crystal Tower, and this is in the Iron City, and stuff like that. You've got several different plots unfolding. The Skeksis murder a Gelfling is like a sacrifice, and it's witnessed by somebody, and they can like connect their minds, sort of like and like sort of share, almost like Vulcan mind meld, I guess is the easiest way to say it. That was a thing in the original movie, and they're like, oh man, if this guy gets out, he can literally just share his memories with people and they will see what we're doing. So there's a like sort of a countrywide manhunt for him. And even like his father, who's like the captain of the guard, thinks that he's like really did this because this, everybody believes the Skeksis. And then there's a girl Gelfling from like the sort of, cavern dweller ones that has her own quest, and then there's even a third one who's a princess who has a vision in a library that's all going to sort of clearly, I think, either put them together in one place at one time. Ultimately, I'm about three episodes in of the nine or ten.
Okay, sure, about where I am then.
Yeah, and it's so the weird thing is I really liked it at first. Then I hit some stuff that I kind of was, that reminded me of the original movie, a little too weird, a little too grim at sometimes. But like I've continued to find it sort of compelling, and like I like hanging out in that world setting.
See, it's interesting. I started watching this and I got the vibe that you were digging it and you were kind of into it, and I was going to ask what was, I guess maybe I'm just not that impressed by the puppetry. Like, it's impressive, but I don't care.
Yeah.
And so I'm struggling to get. The only reason I'm watching this is because we're going to talk about it on our podcast this week. My TV podcast.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, it's homework, so I got to watch through it. And I was struggling to get through it. It just wasn't like grabbing me.
Well, thanks for bringing the room down, Randy.
Sorry. The thing is, like, it's not because it's bad. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And by all accounts,
I actually would never have pointed you to it. I don't think it's up your alley. And I think you have to have sort of a certain fondness for both the fantasy genre and even, like, kind of what the original movie was attempting.
Well, that's kind of the point I was trying to get at, is what is the big draw of this beyond... I mean, if you're not into it for the puppetry, if that is not a thing, is it something that still stands on its own?
I like the characters and I like the story. It is not Game of Thrones deep on that story, because it has a sort of... It's almost like has a YA vibe, and yet it's a kind of dark YA style.
Yeah, dark drama.
Yes. It is unique, and it is also, I feel like they really stayed close to Jim Henson's vision in the sense that it does have that 70s weird, dark, new agey stuff going yeah. on. There's a little bit of kind of grotesquery in it. One of the Skeksis loses an eye in a really kind of horrific way, but it ties into because this is a prequel, that's a thing where this character is around in the original movie, and he has like a mechanical eye, and you essentially see in this how that happened. So it's sort of serving, and in its weird way, it kind of is doing some of the world building like the Marvel Universe and stuff does. I've also read some of the, what do they call it, what are the myth stories or whatever that they did,
creation myths
that they did for the graphic novels from Archaea.
Yeah.
And so I'm also somewhat getting a big picture of the connections between these that's enjoyable. But you kind of have to buy into the weird world it's selling.
Yeah.
And I'm mostly buying into it. With some of the smaller objections that I had to the original movie still cropping up occasionally. But I think it's one of those, like, for people who think they might be interested in it, should try it out. If you don't think you would, don't try it out.
Well, that's what's interesting is that I've been watching my friends, and some of them are going nuts for this. It's like, this is like event TV for them. It's like, they've been waiting all year for this to come out.
Are they Dark Crystal fans, though?
Some of them are, yeah.
I do know, definitely among my fans, you know, among the sort of weird, puppety, all-ages movies of the 80s, there was like Labyrinth, there was Dark Crystal, I feel like there's another
one. I'm blanking on it.
But if nothing else, there was movies like, kind of like, sort of schlocky fantasy like Kroll and stuff like that from the era.
Legend.
You know, Legend. You know I love Kroll.
I do.
Do you think this is...
But also Willow. And weirdly, I think this has a little in common with Willow with, you know, kind of a little bit of the goofy sense of humor sometimes.
Do you think this is approachable to people who have never seen The Dark Crystal?
I've never seen The Dark Crystal. Oh, okay. And I didn't find it...
But do you think that's a negative for it because you don't have the connection?
I think it's possible, but I actually think that... I wanted to try going in to see that because Dark Crystal's streaming on Prime. I could watch it. But I think not knowing anything about it except that the word Skeksis and the word Gelfling, literally all I knew about Dark Crystal... they did a really good job. That voiceover by Sigourney Weaver really introduced you to the world. Like, you can definitely just jump in here and you're going to get a full story.
I thought the voices are great. The actors.
This is a big cast.
I'm going to blank on everybody, but like Lena Headey is
Mark
in
Hamill
there.
Is the scientist, and it's instantly recognizable. Yeah.
A little distracting to me, to be honest.
Yeah, it is,
like, he's very close to his Joker voice. Yeah. Yeah. There's like so many of them that I'm not forgetting, but like Helena Bonham Carter, Keegan-Michael Key, Andy Samberg, Natalie Dormer, Simon Pegg,
yeah,
Alicia, Vikander, Eddie Izzard, Jason Isaacs, Toby Jones, Mark Strong, Harvey Fierstein.
It's an impressive voice.
Harvey Fierstein?
Yep.
Awesome.
He is one of the Skeksis.
Yeah.
Awkwafina. Is in there. Now, a lot of times they actually, you probably won't catch on to them. You might hear something, but like it's a little, to me, lost in the puppetry and stuff.
I agree, and I think that's a good thing in general, other than Mark Hamill.
Right.
I didn't pick out anybody's voices.
The Mark Hamill, Sigourney Weaver, I think those were the only two ones I noticed. Like, if you ask me who Keegan-Michael Key was,
I don't know. I know Jason Isaacs is the like head of the Skeksis, and only because I look things up.
Okay, that makes sense. He's got a lot of gravitas to his voice.
He's playing the type, so he's playing the villain.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll probably like report back once I get to the end. I'm definitely on board enough to watch the rest of it. And I think there's something about, like, I've always liked those stop-motion animated holiday specials and stuff like that. The sort of the otherworldly specifics of physical creations. Not just, like, CG kind of can't quite match it. The puppetry in this is, like, it actually mimics the puppetry of the time where it's, like, they could have made it more naturalistic and probably done more fancy effects. But, you know, like, they have that very specific, I think of it as the Kermit the Frog walk, the little bouncy hop sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that everybody in Jim Henson's everything he ever made kind of has that walk. But I like it. It's kind of charming and sort of there's a physicality to the world that feels like you could go walking around in this place.
Yeah, I agree.
And probably die horribly. I do think, like, parents of kids who are like the kids who like the kind of weird stuff, give this a try.
Nick, you started watching The Terror on AMC?
Yeah, and this goes against type in a lot of different ways, mainly because AMC makes boring shows.
That's true.
They're mainly because of pacing issues.
Yeah.
This
You're talking, of course, about Breaking Bad and Mad Men, right?
I am talking about
Mad Men. Yeah, both Breaking Bad and Mad Men have pacing.
They're weirdly paced.
Yeah, okay. They're slow. They just happen to be great, but they're slow.
And Walking Dead, weirdly paced.
Yeah.
But this one, I like it because it's kind of like quiet.
Mm-hmm.
But this basically
this
the
show
terror
came out like a was it like a year or so back
year yeah it was last
was
year
running this year
season two right is going on right now. I think there's six episodes in. Like, main character is George Takei. It's about a Japanese internment camp. The first one, however, is an adaptation of a Dan Simmons novel called The Terror. And
it's like Arctic horror, right?
Yes, it kind of takes quasi-historical things because it's about two British Navy ships looking for a Northwest Passage.
Mm-hmm.
And these, like, they disappear and then no one knows what happened to them. This is sort of perpetuating a possibility.
So is that a historical thing?
Yeah, it's
okay,
a historical.
So they disappeared, and this is like, here's the scary reason it disappeared.
The last time it was seen was by, like, whalers in the Norwegian Sea or something.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they get, like, stranded in ice. Like, literally, they become landlocked with ice.
I remember just from the trailers that I watched for this before it was hitting, that it looked like there was some kind of dark Arctic survival stuff,
yeah,
maybe?
There is definitely that. But you also get sort of the wherewithal of the British Navy, not only the people who volunteered for the job because they were paid for it, but also, like, the British troops that are there just kind of, like, because that's their job.
Right. Keep a stiff upper lip. Don't mind the Wendigo.
It is very kind of prim and proper and sort of like the British Navy. Like, they are kind of like, you have to be happy or you have to keep up tempo about this.
Right, right. It's their thing.
It is their thing. And then you throw Jared Harris as sort of one of the captains who kind of got not like, I mean, he didn't want to be there, but he kind of got tasked to it.
Right.
And Jared Harris is amazing. I swear he's in every freaking thing I watch, and I love him.
He's in the other thing I'm going to talk about this week, too.
But, I mean,
what's he best known for?
He was in Mad Men.
Okay.
Most recently he was Chernobyl.
He was in Chernobyl. He was Moriarty in the Sherlock Holmes, Robert Downey Jr.
Yep.
Sherlock
yep.
Holmes.
Yep, yep.
But he's also been in just kind of everything.
He's been in a ton of stuff. He's never in the MCU, has he?
No, but dear God, why haven't you cast him? Because he should play somebody.
He's great.
But yeah, he plays this sort of drunkard captain, and it's really great. Then it gets to sort of like the not monster, but there's something.
Right.
They think it's a bear. Mm-hmm. And there's more to it, and I'm not going to go into that because I know Dave will end up watching this and I don't want to spoil anything. But it is shot really, really well. I actually think the
I got pretty good vibes from it from the trailer, and it was only because I didn't have AMC that I didn't dive into it.
The budget is great. It's well shot. The cast is a lot.
And is it a standalone? Like,
yeah, it's 10 episodes.
Did you get to the end of it?
Not yet. I'm 6 episodes in.
Okay, so it could stink.
No. I don't think so.
No. I'll be curious that you should revisit this and let us know what you think.
Yeah, but
of the
I watched
ending.
6 episodes last night.
Right.
Which is not unheard of for me, but lately it's been,
that was a pretty hardcore marathon.
It's a hardcore marathon of it's a little dark, it's a little depressing, it's a little creepy, it's a little gory.
But like the British, you must keep calm.
You must keep calm and carry
and chop the ice, the ship from the ice.
Yeah, I highly recommend it, especially for September.
Right, and it does seem like
the first
if that's good, then the second season, like it sounds like, and we were talking about this earlier, a little bit the way American Horror Story is an anthology series, each year is different, but they kind of gravitate to sort of pop horror concepts, and this sounds like it's kind of doing eerier, creepier horror.
Yeah, it's like
anthology.
Quiet horror in a lot of ways.
Yeah, a little bit more of the disturbing, a little bit more Lovecraft than Stephen King.
Correct.
So the other thing that I watched is on Prime. It's Carnival Row. This is
I've seen people talking about that.
Orlando sort of, Bloom.
Yeah, it's Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne, both of whom have been boring in a lot of things.
Yep.
This is basically it's a Victorian fantasy world with the Fae in it. So it looks like sort of
they're a known thing, right?
It's like 19th century London, but it's not actually London. It's a separate fantasy world. Basically, there's these two factions. There's the Pact
mm-hmm.
and the Burg. And the Burg is where most of this takes place. And they basically were fighting this proxy war over Tir na Loc, which is the, like, fantasy, the Fey realm.
Right.
So the Berg pulled out. There's definitely sort of a Vietnam-era analog sort of thing. Like, basically, their government pulled them out, and the Fey are now refugees coming from the pact-overrun Fey world.
I remember seeing the trailers for this, and yeah, that seemed to be the key thing that I took away from the trailer was... It looked like it was like in London that was filled with refugee fairy people.
Yeah, and there's a lot of racism against them. There is a unseelie Spring-Heeled Jack who's out there murdering or hurting the Fae. Yeah. There's some kind of big thing lurking in the background. The focus is on this ex-soldier, now inspector, played by Orlando Bloom, who was in love with this fairy who basically was a soldier and became was sort of helping fairy refugees get out. In the first part of the first episode, she winds up in this in the Berg, and she quickly finds out that, like, as with all refugees, they're taken in and they become indentured servants to these highfalutin Victorian royalty types. So she becomes this sort of servant who pours tea for her and has to be living in their house and that kind of stuff. There's a romance plot between the two of them, and there are some interesting sort of tensions as, like, the lady of the house, who's this kind of snobby young lady, discovers that the royalty that's moved next to them is Fae royalty, and she sort of does not okay with it, but she's also very intrigued by it. There's a lot of very on-the-nose racism, anti-immigrant sentiment stuff being done here. It's the story itself, like, a romance between Cara Delevingne and Orlando Bloom is maybe those four. Like, I cannot invest in them. I don't care. They're both really...
They're like, I noticed that you're pretty. Did you notice that I, too, am pretty?
Yeah.
Would you like to romance?
They're both such charisma sinks, and that's a shame.
He was only his best performance as Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
That was him and his most charismatic.
And he was a charisma sink in that, too.
Wait.
He's
Orlando Bloom, you don't think, and then, like, Lord of the Rings?
No, Orlando Bloom's fine Lord of the Rings, but he's not.
He's a cypher, though.
He was bringing something to... I feel like he was bringing something to Legolas. Legolas is a beloved character.
Yeah.
He's not forgettable character.
Sure, I mean, I guess if you had a bow and arrow, then maybe, but no, not in general. At any rate, the two lead characters in the romance is a bit of a focus, and unfortunately I'm not as into it. That said... I'm curious about sort of the Fae god that seems to be, like, lurking in the background. That seems to be one of the things they're worried about. I'm interested in the political stuff, and the production is really impressive. Like, having the sort of the Fae with their horns and the wings. Basically, if nothing else, this has proven to me that they can pull off a Saga TV show.
Brian Vaughn's Saga.
Yeah, it looks great, and they're sort of their weird fantasy Victorian London thing. In the third episode, which I'm only about four episodes in the third episode, they do a flashback to how these two characters met, and it's in the Fae world, and they're at this, like, monastery, and the Pact starts showing up in these airships, and the Fae go up with, like, these Molotov cocktails that throw at the airship, and one of the Pact guys are using, like, a hand cranked Gatling gun to shoot them down, and it's a very evocative, cool segment. So there's a lot of cool ideas in here.
What network or whatever is
it's
this?
On Prime.
It's on Prime. Okay.
And the other nice thing about Prime, they do 8-episode seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm four episodes in. I'm going to try at least
through.
Get through the rest of it. I wish the leads had more charisma, but the actual writing is solid enough. The production is gorgeous.
I can't remember if you said this at the beginning or not, but is this based on anything?
No, it's a brand new series as far as I know.
Okay. I mean, it effectively sounds like, like an original urban fantasy kind of concept.
If you told me Neil Gaiman was involved in this, I'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Randy, you said you had friends who were big into Dark Crystal.
Yeah.
What are friends saying about this one? Is it
I have several friends who are big into this one as well.
Interesting.
I think the thing for this and Dark Crystal both, the thing that's keeping me from it is I am not a big fantasy guy.
Yeah.
Like, I used to be much more of a fantasy guy, and now I'm more of science fiction. And so steampunk fairies is not my bag, and magical elves is not my bag.
Yeah.
So I think that is what keeps me from it, even though they're both done pretty well.
Fair enough.
That is it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
yo, Joe.
Something is killing the children.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.